Chapter 10, Race History. The racial question is the key to world history. All is race. There is no other truth. That was spoken by Benjamin Disraeli. Science moves inexorably toward the truth of race. Race is simply genetics, is applied to the breeds of mankind, and it speaks to us in blood types and genotypes, in physical traits and mental abilities, in behavior and temperament, in human achievement and human failure. It tells us more about human life than cultural characteristics do, because it's the engine that makes our cultures what they are. Culture is simply a veneer reflecting the deeper genetic makeup of people. Race bequeaths diversity to this planet that affects all aspects of life. As the voices of science become more articulate on race, history and social studies speak to us just as powerfully on the subject. Recently, a distraught friend called me and told me how Jimmy, his first grader, had come home from school to tell his father that he learned where civilization came from. The 7-year-old boy led his father to his lighted globe and immediately pointed to the heart of the African continent. He proudly announced, "That's where black people and the first civilizations came from." Stunned by his answer, my friend asked his child, "Jimmy, can you tell me where white people came from?" "I don't know," said the little blue-eyed boy. The ultimate determinant of fitness for civilization is not IQ tests or psychological studies, but the straightforward barometer of performance. Even back in the time of my initial race awakening, there was some laughed at babble about great black civilizations. Obscure Afrocentrist claims looked upon as ludicrous in the 1960s are now frequently taught in public schools. Afrocentrism, or the idea that civilization originated in black Africa, thrives, although there's not a shred of evidence that even a single black-created civilization ever developed in sub-Saharan Africa. Even ancient Egypt is being claimed as a black civilization, despite the fact that the oldest Egyptian mummies found are distinctly Caucasian and are classed as such by innumerable anthropologists and archaeologists. Any modern medical investigator competent to racially identify badly decomposed human remains would quickly classify the Egyptians as white. Even the fact that prominent-nosed, fair-skinned, and straight-haired whites are subjects of the art and the hieroglyphics of the Egyptian tombs has not deterred egalitarians from desperately clinging to fantasies that ancient Egypt was an example of black historic achievement. They have even gone so far as to depict Queen Cleopatra, who was wholly of Greek lineage, the last of the Ptolemies, who ruled from 330 to 30 BC, as an Afro-wearing black woman. Some of the purveyors of black history solemnly allege that the Greeks stole philosophy and civilization from Africa. One would be hard-pressed to understand how one steals civilization. If a nation copies another's inventiveness or ideas, does that stop the originator from using it? And if a people are gifted enough to create a great civilization, art, philosophy, and mathematics, what keeps them from continuing to replenish the fountainhead of human accomplishment? The inescapable fact is that black Africa has neither created nor even been able to sustain a high civilization. One of the most respected historians of the 20th century, Arnold Toynbee, listed what he calls 33 historic civilizations. Most are European, some are Asian, but none are black. Poor black historical performance correlates with the evidence of marked differences in intelligence between blacks and whites. In America, school children are taught endlessly about the great achievements of black Americans. With a straight face, teachers recount the most important black contributions to the modern world and then give examples such as the traffic light and the paper bag. The very fact that these things are listed as great black achievements betrays their paucity. No black is found in Michael Hart's The Hundred, the ranking of the most influential persons in history. Perhaps even more telling is there's not even one black achievement found in Isaac Asimov's listing of 1,500 great attainments in his Chronicle of Science and Discovery. Far from being a racist, Asimov publicly expresses a belief in racial equality and describes himself as a liberal. Can the invention of the traffic light or the paper bag remotely compare to the development of the Pythagorean theorem, the invention of the first airplane or the first steam engine, the engineering of the pyramids, the architecture of the Parthenon or the Roman aqueducts, the invention of the printing press, the development of the smallpox vaccine, the creation of genetic engineering, the invention of the transistor, or the mathematics and genius that took men to the moon? Such comparisons surely do not demonstrate racial equality. Instead, they suggest a disparity that goes far beyond the differences in intelligence indicated by mere IQ tests. It must be remembered that almost all the great achievements of mankind were the products of the most intelligent 4 or 5% of the population. As the bell curve and every other IQ study have shown, if one group has an average IQ about 15% lower than another, it does not mean that the lower group will have 15% fewer geniuses than the smarter group. The percentage of geniuses will differ by a rate more than 44 to 1 in favor of the more intelligent group. Some researchers say it is closer to 100 to 1, depending on how high the genius IQ level is set. The standard response of racial egalitarians to the fact that blacks account for only a small percentage of great achievements is that black societies were not advanced enough or because their societies were oppressed. Of course, such an argument is only begging the question. For what could have caused this lack of achievement for habitual oppression over thousands of years? If the capabilities for what we call civilization are the same among races, why did blacks not develop even one? In all of black Africa below the Sahara, they never developed any writing and never used the wheel. There is only one vibrant nation in Africa, the Republic of South Africa, a nation now plunging toward the same fate of the rest of black Africa with the ongoing removal of white leadership and skills. Whites dominated investment, government, education, medicine, training, and communication in Africa for 200 years. But in the 40 years since the departure of Europeans, almost every black African nation has steadily declined in its income, education, health care, sanitation, civil rights, and other societal levels. The disintegration in some nations, such as Sudan and Zaire, has been slowed only by the fact that once they have fallen to such low levels, there is simply little room for further decline. In their utter despair, the struggling remnants in many African nations have actually invited Europeans back, and the increased Western investment and aid should improve, even if only marginally, the current appalling conditions. Africa's social disaster cannot be blamed on lack of resources. The continent is the greatest source of untapped resources in the world. In an age where many first world nations have exhausted their resources, Africa has an excellent opportunity, which it has squandered. From the early 1970s to the 1990s, black Africa's share of world trade has fallen 50%. Its gross national product has declined about 2% per year. Food production has declined almost 20%. Malnutrition has increased, genocidal warfare has increased, AIDS is pandemic, and the continent has even less a semblance of democracy than it had just 25 years ago. Skyscrapers built and once maintained by Europeans in Nigeria, now have intermittent electricity and toilets that overflow. Sanitation, hospitals, power generation, and telephone services all depend on foreign financial aid, and imported Europeans must keep them running even at the most minimal levels. European colonialists who once curbed the bloody tribal warfare were no longer present to stop the Hutus and the Tutus from murdering between 600,000 and 1 million people in Zaire. European colonists who outlawed slavery in Africa over 100 years ago are no longer present in great enough numbers to stop the enslavement of tens of thousands of Africa today. Slavery is technically outlawed in every country of the world, but in Africa it is still widespread. It is present to a degree in almost every African nation. Sudan, Ghana, Mauritania, in particular, are acknowledged as the world leaders in the slave trade. In the Nuba Mountains of Sudan alone, 30,000 African children were sold into slavery in the mid-1990s for the price of 2 chickens each. Racial egalitarians blame Europeans and white racism for the African disaster. Some have argued that the Europeans did not adequately prepare Africa for independence. Yet, while the decolonization went on, some European nations adamantly maintained that more time was needed to develop the African nations before their independence. Such claims were dismissed by white liberals in the West and by African tin pot revolutionaries as racist and patronizing. Of course, the very idea of a need for preparation for independence begs the question, for who prepared the European nations for their independence? Of course, egalitarians always have an excuse for black historical failure. The latest apologia for the lack of African culture argues that climatic and ecological factors facilitated development of civilization in Eurasia, but prevented it in Africa. Jared Diamond, though, does not answer the question of why successful colonization by the Arabs preserved civilized qualities for centuries until the colonist race was subsumed by the native black population, and why the spark of civilization in Africa only burned when the European was there to sustain it. The next section is race and nation. When the race is good, so is the place, as said Ralph Waldo Emerson. As I became more aware of the profound biological differences between the races and better understood the impact of these differences in education, crime, poverty, and other societal issues, I began to read about the historical realities of race and culture. If racial composition can have a great impact on a school, how much does it have on a nation? Can race be instructive about the development and conditions of nations? One of my friends in high school, George Cardella, came from Colombia. He spoke to me at length about the conditions of his own and other South American lands. Often his revelations of the low living standards and crude human values startled me. He was conscious of his light blue eyes and European Spanish ancestry and talked frankly about the racial realities of his and other South American nations. In geography class, my teacher pointed out that South America has more potential geographic development than North America. It is larger in temperate land area, richer in resources, more varied in climate and topography, and had quite a head start, being intensely settled and exploited earlier than North America. The question naturally arises, why then are the countries south of the Rio Grande usually so much poorer, more unhealthy, less educated, and less free than those in the United States and Canada? South America had substantial settlements and in some places even universities before the rudimentary outposts at Jamestown and Plymouth. Spain and Portugal, nations with a rich European cultural heritage, settled the region. The modern-day discovery of America by Christopher Columbus occurred the same year as the victory over the Moors, finally expelling them from all of Spain after a struggle lasting hundreds of years. The Spanish conquistadors were fit and fearless, forged by the crucible of war and a fight for freedom that spanned generations. Suddenly, the national unity and purpose born of the victorious war with the Moors shifted to conquering and civilizing a new land and a new world. It wasn't long until the auburn-haired, green-eyed Isabella ruled Spanish possessions larger than the size of all of Europe. The Spanish and Portuguese ruthlessly exploited the native population of the Americas, and those aboriginals they did not kill in war, disease often dispatched. The discovery of precious metals such as gold and silver and the vast tracts of land then in possession of the Spanish throne encouraged the Spanish to integrate with and use the native population to develop the resources. Spanish rulers were spread thin in the immense empire, a tiny minority in a sea of color. Because the physical and psychological character of the Indians adapted poorly to servitude in some regions, to satisfy their need for laborers, they imported black slaves from Africa. Whether conquistador or priest, their primary task was exploitive in nature. The conquistador to cultivate the land's riches, the priest to harvest the inhabitants' souls. Living in a land with few white women and ample Indian maidens and black slave women, mixed liaisons and marriages were common, although such unions were looked down upon by the more aristocratic classes, who often sent their sons and daughters home to Spain to find a husband or wife. The Spanish built Mexico and their other colonies throughout the Caribbean, Central and South America in their own image. They established schools, government buildings, and churches, and carried the art, technology, and culture of European civilization to the New World. In addition to Spain and Portugal, Great Britain, France, and Holland also had colonies and possessions in the Western Hemisphere. In the vast expanse, only 13 American colonies in Canada had white majorities. In North America, where there was a presence of non-whites, whether slave or free, social intercourse among the Europeans was exclusively white. In North America, Europeans came over by the hundreds of thousands, bringing their families with them, and the farming lifestyle made large families desirable, causing little shortage of women, except at the very edges of the frontier. Thus, America and Canada became overwhelmingly white nations, while the Caribbean, Central, and South Americas remained mostly non-white, except for a veneer of white leadership and control. It seemed obvious to me that the overwhelming difference between the Canadian and American colonies and the rest of the Americas was simply that of race. I discussed some of these facts with my geography teacher in high school, Mrs. Weir. She was a dyed-in-the-wool egalitarian who blustered that there were other factors that I failed to consider in my hypothesis. Her first counterargument was that North America was mostly Protestant and thus driven by the work ethic intrinsic to that denomination. My retort to that was easy. The Renaissance of Western civilization itself began in northern Italy, an exclusively Catholic society. And Quebec, a North American city, was not Protestant but had living standards far more similar to Protestant America than Mexico or Brazil. Next, she tried to argue that it was simply the democratic traditions of North America compared to the autocratic ones of South America that gave and made such pronounced differences. I pointed out that history is full of examples of both tyrannies that had become democratic and democracies that had lost their freedoms. The aristocracies of Europe certainly became great and modern nations. Many of the governing constitutions of the Middle and Southern Hemisphere nations were modeled directly after our own United States Constitution, but those instruments of law did not save them from poverty, massive corruption, tyranny and assassination, continuous revolution, illiteracy, disease, and primitive lifestyles and conditions. I ask her, when one considers that there are dozens of nations in the Caribbean and the Americas, and that there have been hundreds of revolutions and marked political changes over the centuries, are we supposed to believe that none of them ever got it right? In response to her silence, I blurted out, perhaps the thing that really makes or breaks a nation is not its institutions, but the race of its people. The race factor is seen in the differences that exist among many different nations of the Americas. Costa Rica is readily acknowledged as the most advanced nation in Central America, It has a reputation as the least corrupt government and as the one having the highest living standard and literacy rate of the region. It also prides itself on being the whitest nation of Central America. Consider the fact that the most advanced nations of South America are Argentina, Uruguay, and Chile, the nations with the continent's highest percentages of Europeans. Racial impact can also be seen within nations themselves. Brazil, for instance, is much like two different nations when one considers the backward black regions in the north and the more European ones in the south. When I visited Brazil in 1991, I readily noticed how the population became blacker and poorer as one neared the traditional lands of the black slave plantations and whiter and wealthier in the more mountainous regions. The same is true for the old plantation river parishes of Louisiana as compared to the whiter ones. It became obvious to me that if America's demography changes into one resembling that of South America, we will become like those societies. We will lose our precious heritage and way of life. I became convinced that race is the dominant force of society, influencing every aspect of our lives. Even if a society does not overtly state it or even acknowledge it, race imprints nations, just as it does individuals, with characteristics and traits that egalitarianism cannot explain away. The lessons of race taught by the history of the Western Hemisphere are pertinent to the history of all nations and all cultures. One can even examine prehistory and find that there have always been tribes that shared a particular gene pool and common characteristics that distinguished them. Nations arose from people who shared a common heritage. They have not always been completely monoracial, but they were always formed by a dominant people that made the country in its own image, its own culture, values, language, and artistic tastes. Nations were not determined strictly by geography, as borders were often poorly defined and amorphous in historical times, but by the people who populated them. For instance, whether the people were Assyrians, Egyptians, Jews, Greeks, Romans, or the French, nations arose out of the races or sub-races that composed them. The term France, for instance, came from the name of the people who rebuilt the country after the fall of the Roman Empire, the Franks. One can trace the history of nations and the racial history and character of its inhabitants. One of the first history books my father gave me to read in grade school was H.G. Wells' classic, The Outline of History. Its theme is the rise and fall of nations. A great people arise having intelligence, strength, and ambition. They create a powerful society and conquer their less fit neighbors. And then begins a process of absorbing the conquered in their nation-state. The traits that originally led them to victory and dominance are lost as they gradually absorb the defeated population. Invariably, the process begins again, and another people come on the scene and conquer, only to once more be absorbed by those they had vanquished. Such a pattern was obvious to me in studying the Americas, but now as I read more history, it became obvious to me that the race factor is present in the rise and fall of every civilization. In fact, in every fallen civilization, there had been a racial change from the original founding population. The only real justification for the survival of a nation is a racial one, the survival of that specific population as a distinct genetic entity, as a source for the next generation. Otherwise, such a nation would not be worth defending in a world of many nations. Historians such as Toynbee, Durant, and Spengler have chronicled the emergence and decline of nations. Interestingly, every great civilization that has graced the earth fell into decay and to destruction. Ours is simply the latest of many civilizations that have risen only to subsequently decline. The ultimate question of the historians is why civilizations have this cycle. There are many theories on why civilizations decline: economic downturns, political corruption, military weakness and defeat, moral decay from the breakdown of religious tradition, class warfare, degeneration from wealth. There are as many theories as there are historians. But one factor is present in the rise and fall of every civilization known to mankind, and that's the race factor. The racial group that built the original civilization lost its dominance, often even its genetic integrity. Before I learned about race, I too had my theories based on what I had read. Mine were based purely on the symptoms of the declines rather than on the underlying factors causing the symptoms. A book written well over 100 years ago by a French scholar, Count Arthur de Gobineau, proposed a hypothesis on the decline of civilization that had me thinking about the issue for weeks, and it ultimately led me to my worldview on the race issue. De Gobineau's Inequality of the Races was written before Darwin's Origin of Species, and long before many of the modern principles of biology and psychology and genetics. But it put forth the startling propositions that populations were undergoing change in their biological character, and that civilization was ultimately the product of biology, the racial characteristics of its founders. De Gobineau claimed that civilizations declined because the inherent makeup of its creators had changed. The racial quality of the people had declined. He saw it as an intra-racial and interracial weakening of the culture-creating race. It was interracial in that the cosmopolitan nature of the empire caused racial mixing with alien peoples, and declining birth rates among the founding race accompanied by overpopulation of the mixed multitudes. De Gobineau also recognized an intra-racial decline. The ruling race, the most intelligent, productive citizens, had the fewest children, while the lower elements were extremely prolific. De Gobineau wrote during the mid-19th century, before modern biology, which meant that his book would contain many eras. Yet his theses are remarkably astute. De Gobineau was well-traveled for his time, and he had the power to dispassionately observe and interpolate what he encountered. Once one understands race, it is easy to recognize the racial component in the history of nations and its role in contemporary societies around the world. A classic example of race history is the study of the Egyptian civilization. Purveyors of black history make the ludicrous claim that Egypt was a black civilization. They point to some Negroid features in the last of the pharaohs as proof of this contention. It is indeed true that the last pharaoh may have been part black. At the end of 3,000 years, there might have been intrusion of some black genes into the ruling family. That fact does not make the basis of Egyptian civilization black any more than Jesse Jackson becoming president of the United States, or Barack Obama for that matter now, would make the signers of our Declaration of Independence Negroes. When black genes appeared in the Egyptian royal family, their presence signified the end of the Egyptian civilization. Just as Jesse Jackson being elected president would write a similar epitaph for America. Now, looking back on this, doing an audio book, I don't think yet the epitaph of our country is written by the election of Barack Obama. But maybe if Jesse Jackson were elected with his type of character and record, maybe that would indeed be true. There are thousands of surviving hieroglyphics depicting the builders of the Egyptian civilization as white people, some with reddish hair and light eyes. The oldest recovered mummies show the remains to be white. Egypt had a civilization in some ways reminiscent of the Old South, in much the same way as the aristocratic white society of the South brought black slaves from the African slave traders Egyptian whites brought black slaves up for labor from the Lower Nile. Over thousands of years, licit and illicit sexual contact between the races eventually carried black genes even into the royal family. The completion of that process coincided perfectly with the demise of the longest enduring set of dynasties the world has ever seen, and the collapse of the Egyptian civilization. And by the way, another side note for the audiobook. This past summer, I had the distinct pleasure to meeting with my friend Jean-Marie Le Pen, in fact, on my birthday. And during that period, I was able to spend a number of days and wonderful hours in the Louvre Museum. And they have examples of mummies and art and other artifacts from the Egyptian civilization, all listed from the very earliest dynasties to the last dynasties. I took some pictures, I'll probably put them in the next edition of My Awakening, of the earliest dynasties, and it's just amazing to see how European the earliest dynasties are. Very straight noses, very strong European features, extremely thin lips, very distinct European body types. It's just very interesting, and it was interesting to note these in the museum and compare them with the later dynasties. Egypt today is a varied population, from the purest of blacks to a vast mixed population and even a small white minority. The lighter elements of the educational, scientific, political, and business elite. I know a number of Egyptians myself who I would certainly consider European in every regard. Few people have fallen as far as the once great Egyptian nation has. The Egyptian nation is one of the poorest on earth, with rampant poverty and crime. There are an estimated 60,000 street beggars in Cairo alone, and thousands of infants are purposely blinded or crippled and put on the street to beg for their cruel masters. The racial story of Egypt is a clear and dramatic one because of the obvious racial impact of the admixture of the black race. Even civilizations that underwent less dramatic racial mixing than Egypt lost the impetus of their cultures. Ancient Greece was probably the most culturally and artistically advanced civilization the world's ever seen. Probably 98% of Greek art has been lost over the last two millennia. Yet we still marvel at the magnificence of their architecture, sculpture, paintings, poetry, songs, plays, philosophy, and literature. Not only were the Greeks great thinkers and artists, they were also great warriors, having conquered almost the entire known world. Alexander the Great, actually an Arian Macedonian, at one time in a short life, had even expanded the Greek Empire as far as the plains of India. The Greeks accomplished all this, although the total population of Athens and Sparta combined never exceeded 250,000 people. Greek civilization is called the Golden Age, and the Greek people were described as a golden people because of the presence of so many blondes. Greek literature is full of descriptions of fair-complected, light-eyed people. Their sculptures record their physical traits, for they were tall, magnificent people who attended to the health and beauty of their bodies, just as they did to their creative minds. The Greeks, much as the Spanish in South America, were few in numbers, but conquered and administered over vast populations and land areas. Alexander dealt with the demographic problem by urging his soldiers and sailors to marry the ruling class women of the countries Greece ruled. On one occasion, 10,000 Greek soldiers married 10,000 Persian women in a mass ceremony. Although those unions were later voided, they symbolized the Greek strategy for their imperialism. Alexander thought he was binding the loyalty of the nations he subdued and simply creating more Greeks. He thought culture and learning was something you could basically transfer into other peoples. But Greeks returning home with their foreign brides initiated a process that undermined their whole civilization. Non-Greeks from all over the Mediterranean world immigrated to Greece for the same economic and social reasons that Mexicans crossed the Rio Grande. Much like the great trading cities of the world today, Greek cities became a melting pot of diverse races. Over the centuries, Greek cities became such a melting pot that few Greeks retained the physical characteristics described in the Odyssey and captured for eternity in their preserved sculptures that we marvel at today. A people were lost in an alien genetic flood, and the vitality of the civilization ebbed away, only to be found in the writings, remnants, and ruins of the past. Since the fall of the Greek civilization, the peninsula has been replenished, thankfully and frequently, by migrations from the north areas of Greece, and there are still genes of the original Greeks in many of the citizens there today. The nation, though, is a shadow of the splendor that it once was, and it finds its highest meaning in its glorious antiquity rather than the bright eyes of a bright future. In many ways, the great Roman civilization resembled that of the Greeks. The founding Romans were called patricians. Random House, Webster's Electronic Dictionary, defines patrician as follows. Patrician, noun. 1. A person of noble or high rank, aristocrat. 2. A person of breeding, education, and refinement. 3. A member of the original hereditary aristocracy of ancient Rome, having such privileges as the exclusive right to hold certain offices. 4. In the later Roman and Byzantine empires, a non-hereditary honorary title or dignity conferred by the emperor. Boy, there's a lot in that definition, isn't there? There's a lot to say. As Rome ruled the known world, the city of Rome itself became the New York City of the ancient world. Roman chroniclers talked about walking in the streets of Rome in its declining period as if it were a foreign land filled with alien appearances and languages and religions. One can trace the decline of Roman power directly to, as the fourth definition shows, the transition of the patrician from a hereditary title to an honorary one. Another indication of the genetic basis of the original Roman civilization can be found in the common Jewish word Gentiles, which derived from the Roman term gens, a term used to denote the true Roman families that built and for a time ruled the Roman Empire. To the Jews of those days, the gens or Gentiles represented the enemy that had conquered them in Palestine. The very term gens is the root of words such as gentleman, gent, genes, genetics, genocide, genus, and other terms of heredity. Gens, noun, a group of families in ancient Rome claiming descent from a common ancestor and united by a common name and common ancestral religious rites. Interesting. In anthropology, a group tracing common descent in the male line or clan, gens, race, people, see genus, gender. And look at the term for gentleman, a man of good family, breeding, or social position. In the commentary for this audio tape, you see again, ladies and gentlemen, how the truth really has been lost in our modern controlled media, even in our definition. Look at that term for gentleman, a man of good family, breeding, or social position, and gens. Rome never sank to the level of modern Egypt because the racial change was far less dramatic than in that nation, but it dramatically declined. Luckily, Italy enjoyed the fresh, hardy European genes of the northern barbarian invaders and conquerors who were not as culturally advanced, but who had the same genetic potential as the original Romans and their patrician standard bearers. As a side note for the audio tape, the northern Italians, of course, were not affected by this multiculturalism, and indeed, that's where the Renaissance primarily occurred. Barbarian is a term, by the way, that probably describes these invaders, for they had a strong moral fiber and family life, and a rich cultural heritage, as well as the intelligence and planning and war to defeat the schooled and experienced Roman armies. When the Renaissance finally laid the cornerstones of our modern Western civilization, it found its impetus primarily not from the great city of Rome with all of its history, centers of learning, and advantages, but from the northern Italian cities of Florence and Padua and Venice. Rome still contained much original Roman blood, but it was no longer the Rome of the Romans. It was now an international city, a melting pot of races from around the world, including even Germanic elements, Egyptians, Semites, and others. The Renaissance found its driving force where more of the original Roman genes still dominated, and even today, the northern provinces are the most economically sound and robust parts of all Italy. The per capita, in fact, the GNP, of northern Italy is equal to that of the strongest economies in Europe. Very strong difference, by the way, from southern Italy. One can see the racial expression in the Renaissance in Michelangelo's masterful fresco of an Arian depiction of God and Adam on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Falsifying history has become a full-time occupation for many in the educational and cultural establishment of America. Not only has Cleopatra become black, it appears that the great Carthaginian general, Hannibal, has begun to take on a decidedly Negro appearance. The Budweiser Beer Company did a poster, an educational series called The Great Kings of Africa, depicting Hannibal as bearing a resemblance to black boxing promoter Don King. Of course, Hannibal was white. Contemporary sources described his appearance in terms which leave no doubt that he was as white as the ancient Carthaginian people that he led. What's more, his death mask shows the thin nose and lips and high forehead of a Caucasian. The mask bears no Negro features or resemblances. The black adoption of famous Europeans as their own does not end with Cleopatra or Hannibal. They've even gone so far as to ludicrously allege Ludwig von Beethoven was black. And for that matter, anyone with curly hair and who is swarthy is claimed by Afrocentrists desperate for validation. Liberal historians act as if civilization and advanced nations represent some cosmic accident. To them, successful nations are just lucky. And but for luck, one people would be either illiterate and poor or another cultured and rich. Yet the world has abundant examples of ecologically rich nations that are culturally and economically destitute, and resource-poor nations that are culturally enlightened and economically rich. Nations can be found with long histories that are now either progressive or backward. Short national histories can herald great success or abject failure. Societies can be religiously devout or ambivalent. There are poor nations, there are poor devout nations, there are rich agnostic ones, and vice versa. Constitutions and laws on the books do not really tell us how free or law-abiding a nation is, but the race usually tells us a great deal. There are relatively isolated nations that are wealthy and advanced, and ones in the thick of cultural and economic traffic that are very poor. Is there one sizable, well-run, all-black nation where the crime rate is low, the schools good, the government free and uncorrupted? Is there one with high longevity rates and low infant mortality, or with low illiteracy and a high standard of living? The impact of race on history and contemporary social conditions can be well illustrated by comparing two nations, Haiti and Iceland. Iceland sits inside the Arctic Circle. It is perhaps the most inhospitable geography of any populated nation on Earth. It stands isolated and endures conditions that last almost three quarters of the year. No forests grow there, and thus it has no good wood or paper products. There is no oil, no natural gas, and no coal. Much of the land is volcanic desert and glaciers so foreboding that the U.S. space program did training there for their lunar landings. Farming is almost impossible because of the rock-filled soil, snow-covered mountains, and short growing season. Few tourists visit the little island in the North Atlantic. It's a land of clouds, little sunshine, and long winter nights. Iceland's only resource is the fish they harvest on the Great Cod Banks in competition with many other nations. They also have natural volcanic geysers that they ingeniously use to heat their homes and businesses, and in some cases, garner from which electric power and energy. Now, compare this island to the island of Hispaniola and the nation of Haiti, the second oldest republic in the entire Western Hemisphere. It is a huge island, rich beyond the dream of a poet's fancy, warm and beautiful with natural, incredibly beautiful beaches, mountains, and clear waters. The topography is a tourist's fantasy. It is one of the great gateway islands of the Caribbean, the United States, Mexico, and South America, a natural place for thriving international trade. Thick forests and rich mineral resources have blessed the island. The seafood in the waters around the nation is plentiful and valuable. Mild weather gives the island long and productive growing seasons and lush soil. In the 18th century, Haiti was the largest sugar producer in the world. Universities and other centers of higher learning kept the island abreast of the world's progress and advances, and it became one of the richest of France's overseas possessions, richer than any of the 13 original American colonies. Haiti came to be called the jewel of the Caribbean. But all this ground to a halt in the late 1790s, when the egalitarianism introduced by whites fresh from the French Revolution precipitated a black revolt on the island, which ultimately caused the murder by black revolutionaries of nearly every one of the 40,000 white men, women, and children on the island. In the 200 years since the revolution, under one corrupt and tyrannical regime after another, Black Haiti has become one of the most dangerous, superstitious, and backward places on earth. The vast majority of the people are illiterate, and less than 3% finish primary education. It has one of the lowest per capita incomes on earth, endemic crime and drug problems, wholesale destruction of the environment, negligible education, high infant mortality, and primitive health care, and its dominant religion is voodoo. The efforts of American missionaries and educators have proven futile, and repeated military incursions have also failed three times. In the last century, U.S. Marines were sent to bring democracy to Haiti. The first mission began in 1915. Marines remained for 19 years, building hospitals, power stations, schools, and modern telephone exchanges, and more than 200 bridges and 1,000 miles of paved roads. Upon their departure, the island reverted back to complete ruin and despotism. In 1958, American Marines returned and began the whole process over again with the same results. In 1994, Americans again returned to Haiti, this time with 23,000 troops as part of a United Nations peacekeeping force. At least 500 troops are expected to remain until at least the next 10 or 15 years in Haiti. This is all to prevent Haiti from reverting back to its old ways. Even with this modern force and accompanying massive U.S. and UN aid, Haiti is politically corrupt, racked by AIDS and other diseases, and chronically criminal. As Haiti approaches the beginning of the second decade of the 21st century, the capital, Port-au-Prince, reeks of human waste and rotting garbage. At the beginning of the 20th century, a British member of the Royal Geographic Society, Hesketh Pritchard, traveled to Haiti to study the effects of an entirely black-ruled country. Upon his arrival, he had strong sympathies with the natives, and he wanted to see how they fared in response to the introduction of white civilization. But without whites ruling over them, he found that although Haiti had French laws and the workings of a civilization on paper, that it was all an illusion of style without real substance. The Haitian army, for instance, had 6,500 privates, but the same number of generals, all with pompously adorned uniforms. They had hospitals with mud floors, train stations and tracks, but no working trains, power-generating plants that generated no power, courts and laws and constitutional rights, but only corruption and despotism. There were Catholic churches, but they were encumbered with primitive voodoo and even animal sacrifices in the churches. Although Pritchard regarded the natives as generally jovial, he found them prone to the cruelest human tortures and atrocities. Pritchard concluded that to Haitians, the veneer of civilization is as important as its substance. If they could dress and speak like a European and have institutions that in form seem like that of Europeans, then they view themselves as equal to the European. In asking the fundamental question, can the Haitian rule himself, Pritchard wrote the following. The present condition of Haiti gives the best possible answer to the question, and considering the experiment has lasted for a century, perhaps also a conclusive one. For a century, the answer has been working itself out there in flesh and blood. The Negro has had his chance, a fair field and no favor. He has had the most beautiful and fertile of the Caribbees for his own. He has had the advantage of an excellent French legal system. He inherited a made country with Cap Haitien, a once beautiful town on the north coast of Haiti, for its Paris. Here was a wide land sown with prosperity, a land of wood and water, towns and plantations, and in the midst of it, the black man was turned loose to work out his own salvation. What has he made of the chances that were given to him? Later he says, at the end of 100 years of trial, how does a black man govern himself? What progress has he made? Absolutely none. Unquote. Iceland, on the other hand, even with all the disadvantages, is one of the best places to live on earth. The nation publishes more books and journals per capita than any other country of the world. It has some of the highest literacy rates and lowest infant mortality rates, lowest crime and drug rates, highest standards of living, best medical care, and the longest standing freely elected parliament in the world, the Althing. Now suppose by some incredible act all the Icelanders were taken to Haiti and all the Haitians taken to Iceland. In 5 years, the Icelanders in Haiti would be living in a paradise they would have built while in Iceland, I suspect, that most Haitians would be dead. I came to the conclusion that the liberals were in a way right about the impact of environment on the individual and groups. Environment has shaped us, but the environment that gave us the genetic code that so deeply influences us came not in the evolutionary millisecond of an individual's short lifespan, but over thousands of years. That is why well-meaning efforts to improve some races of man through his environment invariably fail. And efforts to oppress other races, such as nationalities in the former Soviet bloc, also fail in the end. There have been many once uncivilized areas of the globe that rapidly flourished with economic, social, and scientific achievement after having only the slightest contact with civilization. Conversely, other areas on the borders of civilization for thousands of years never could adapt and sustain civilization's most rudimentary characteristics. A perfect example is the traditional Sudan in North Africa, an area that stretches across northern Africa just south of the Sahara, rich in grasslands, minerals, forests, swamps, even natural seaports in the east that brought trade and the learning of a civilized world. Sudan's only historical bright spots were its colonial outposts of the Egyptians, Arab Muslims, and then later modern Europeans. Contrast the Sudan of today to the descendants of Rome's colonial forays in Britain and France. Not only did those nations adopt the attributes of Roman civilization, even Roman law, they eventually far exceeded them. In the Sudan, after at least 6,000 years of contact, it is little better off than it was in the times of the pharaohs. In fact, it is arguably a lot worse. In the last 30 years since colonial independence, the quality of life has rapidly disintegrated as institutions and organizations set up by the West have been abandoned. The architecture of genes is much more powerful than the institutions of mankind, for institutions come and go, while the genes are forged over millennia. It is the genes themselves that construct the very character of the societies in which they thrive. Every nation rises or sinks according to its genes. Over time, genes override every advantage or impediment. Human genes can make nations with the poorest of resources rich, or the richest of resources poor. They can inspire great universities or make ruins where greatness once stood. They can erect tyranny over once free men, or resurrect freedom from the worst of oppression. Social structures created by race can be imposed on another, but in time, the genes, if preserved, will assert themselves. The power of the gene is the source of space travel, or of squalor, of civilization, or the jungle. The great U.S. Senator from Mississippi, Theodore Bilbo, once wrote that if a foreign nation conquered America and enslaved its people, destroyed its buildings, its crops, its schools, its farms, and its economy, that as long as our white heritage remained intact, we could build it all back even better than it was before. But he warned that if our heritage was lost, then our nation would be forever lost as well. It is true that when I write of the things I love and cherish, I can only be subjective, for my values are the values of my own people. Some men even dispute the virtue of civilization itself. Freedom, beauty, love, achievement, they are all subject to the eye of the beholder. An Indian American, living wild and free in the American forests and grasslands, had his own idea of what is good. And that concept is certainly far more sublime than the mass alcoholism found in the Indian community of today. The African's rhythmic pounding of the drum, his sexual and physical bliss, bare feet against the warm soil, and his sound sleep beneath the open stars have always answered the needs of his soul, needs that grew up and were formed in the continent of Africa. Could anyone deny that such may certainly answer a young man's heart better than imprisonment in the jails of America, or the slavery of crack and heroin, or gunshot wounds suffered in the night? Those nations left to determine their own destiny will always live more in consonance with their natural abilities and spirit. In the end, genes will prevail. Europeans create and maintain European standards of civilizations. Africans create societies much different. By our Western standards, those societies do not measure up, but if blacks are allowed to do so, they will create a society reflective of the spirit inside of them, and as such can only be truly appraised by their own people. An old European proverb states, "Man is happiest at home." I believe that such is true for all men, and all races of men. At the time of the French Revolution, Ernst Arndt, a German patriot seeking to resist the imposition of revolutionary egalitarian ideology, wrote in his Catechism for the Teutonic Army Man that freedom was the right to live in one's own homeland in accordance with the laws and traditions of one's ancestors. I got that quote, by the way, from Hans Günther, his great book, Religiosity of the Indo-Europeans. Going through some of my old notebooks from college, I found some aphorisms that I had written on the subject of race and history. And I think now, many years later, that they're as pertinent today as they were then. Here they are. I'll share them with you. People make a nation. They make it in their genetic image. They compose the music, write the constitutions, create business and economy, give it its soul and its spirit. In the battle between genes and culture, genes will win out. In the struggle between the influence of heredity and environment, in the long run, heredity will always prevail, except when the environment destroys the one thing that man cannot restore, his genetic heritage. If a folk is genetically constructed to be free, no period of tyranny can ever permanently suppress them. If they are genetically amenable to live in tyranny, democracy can be opposed on them, but left to themselves, they will eventually revert to their natural state. Human ecology is as important a concept as nature's ecology. Some races have the capacity to create great social environments, but great social environments can never make great races. Intelligent peoples make great schools and universities. Higher institutions of learning can only reflect the quality of the people. The only ultimate way to improve a society is to improve the genetic capabilities of its people. The surest way to destroy a society is to have programs and policies that systematically favor higher reproduction of the genes of the least capable over the genes of the most capable. It is the sin against the quality of the flesh that causes the sin against the spirit. Widespread race mixing is genocide. Low birth rates is race suicide. Massive immigration of alien races ultimately means genocide. Integration of the races is rapid genocide. Geographic separation creates races and supports their survival. History and geography spoke to me. It was not as though all these ideas were original to me, for writers and travelers from the earliest civilizations wrote and contemplated many of these truths, as well as many of the great thinkers of the 19th and 20th centuries. I now saw a racial picture entirely different from when I started my inquiry. America and most other white nations are following a course similar to the failed civilizations of the past and the failing racially mixed societies of the present. And this is true even in our homelands. I'll give you a side note in this audio tape. Our great nations of Europe, which one couldn't have imagined 50 years ago, would now be facing a racial Armageddon. When previous white empires degenerated and dissolved into the cacophony of racial mixture, there were always our racial homelands from which would come a new generation and new generations to build and create civilization anew. This time, though, the homelands of our people, all the critical fountainheads of our gene pool, are at risk. If all of Western civilization succumbs to this dark genetic flood, there is no more womb from which our people can be born again. I realized that we are in a battle not only for our own civilization this time, but for the preservation of our expression of life on this planet. And now, it was time for me to look into the social, economic, and political impact of race on my own nation and on society in general. The next chapter is Chapter 11, Race and Society.